If you want to follow along in your Bibles, turn to Isaiah chapter 35. Isaiah chapter 35 is the chapter we've made it to thus far. It's been a couple weeks since we were together, so I just want to give you a brief review of the chapters leading up to this one. So remember the first 12 chapters, Isaiah is prophesying about Judah and Jerusalem, and then he opens it up to the nations surrounding them. Then there's a judgment kind of on the world as a whole. Then he starts to get into a lot of very messianic stuff as you get into chapters 27 through 29. And then in chapter 30, Isaiah condemns alliance with Egypt. That comes back in the next few chapters we're going to study, so keep that in mind. Isaiah condemns the alliance with Egypt. And he does that through chapter 31. And in chapter 32 and 33, Isaiah lines out some things about the spiritual kingdom that's coming, and then he prophesies against Assyria up to chapter 34. So we've come to chapter 35, and Isaiah is going to make some connections. He's still prophesying about the salvation of Zion and the judgment that's coming on Assyria. And we're still in that context right now in chapter 35. So he's going to make some connections with some stuff he's already said in the last couple chapters. So in Isaiah chapter 35, in verse 1, he says, "The wilderness and the wasteland shall be glad for them, and the desert shall rejoice and blossom as the rose. It shall blossom abundantly and rejoice, even with joy and singing. The glory of Lebanon shall be given to it, the excellence of Carmel and Sharon. They shall see the glory of the Lord, the excellency of our God." Yeah, the places that he mentions here are really specific, and he is using the same language that he used in chapter 33. So if you go look in chapter 33 and verse 9, where Isaiah is prophesying that the king of Assyria is going to come and do certain things to the land of Judah. He says in verse 9, "The earth mourns and languishes. Lebanon is shamed and shriveled. Sharon is like a wilderness, and Bashan and Carmel shake off their fruits." So then in chapter 35, verse 2, he comes back with, "The glory of Lebanon shall be given to it, the excellence of Carmel and Sharon. They shall see the glory of the Lord, the excellency of our God." So there he's using the same places that he used to talk about the judgment that was coming to talk about the salvation that's coming. So you can see that connection there in Isaiah's prophecy. In verse 3, he says, "Strengthen the weak hands and make firm the feeble knees. Say to those who are feeble-hearted, be strong, do not fear. Behold, your God will come with vengeance. With the recompense of God, he will come and save you." So in verse 3 and 4, there's a call to take courage, a call for the strong to admonish those who are fearful and discouraged to take courage in the face of the threats made by the king of Assyria. As we get into the next few chapters, there's like a little break in the prophecy, and Isaiah goes through a historical narrative about the struggle for power between King Hezekiah and Jerusalem, and the Rabshakeh and Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, and their army. And we'll get into why this is so important, verse 3 and 4, why this is so important as we get into the next few chapters. But strengthen the weak hands, make firm the feeble knees, say to those who are fearful-hearted, be strong, do not fear. In the next few chapters, the spokesman of the king of Assyria comes, and they have a conversation with the ambassadors sent from Hezekiah to talk to them. And the spokesman of Assyria, the title of their station is called the Rabshakeh. That's the word Isaiah uses. So the Rabshakeh, they speak in Hebrew after being asked to speak in Aramaic, because the ambassadors understood Aramaic, so they could talk to the Assyrians without frightening the people who were on the wall, the soldiers who were on the wall of Jerusalem. But the Rabshakeh speaks out loudly in Hebrew and tries to intimidate all of Jerusalem. He speaks blasphemies. He speaks ill of King Hezekiah. And there's a lot of just reproach that this person brings on behalf of the king of Assyria. So Isaiah's admonishment here is, be strong, do not fear. Even though there's all these threats being made, the stuff going on, Isaiah says, be strong, do not fear. Your God will come with vengeance, with the recompense of God, who will come and save you. It harkens back to chapter 34 and verse 8, where it says, for it is the day of the Lord's vengeance, the year of recompense for the cause of Zion. So there's this idea that God is a vengeful God when it comes to protecting his people. And I think that's important for us to remember. A lot of the times we end up seeing in the religious world this idea of God where he's just loving, where he's only accepting, where he's only patient, he's only merciful, but he's also vengeful and just. So we have to remember to balance our thought process about God's nature with that. He's a jealous and vengeful God as well. In verse 5, we see some of the same signs of the spiritual kingdom coming. They get put back into the equation. So Isaiah says, after this salvation from Assyria, the reason I'm saving you from Assyria and still establishing my people is because then the eyes of the blind shall be opened, verse 5, and the ears of the deaf shall be unstopped. Then the lame shall leap like a deer, and the tongue of the dumb sing. For the waters shall burst forth in the wilderness and streams in the desert. So he's making a connection between the spiritual kingdom coming after all of this happens with Assyria. He says, I'm still establishing my people because my work with them is not done yet. I still have more things to get accomplished with Jerusalem as the place where my name is, so it's not going to be taken away. The eyes of the blind, the ears of the deaf, the lame shall walk. These are all things that we've talked about in previous chapters, like chapter 29, where Isaiah brings that in. He says in chapter 29, verse 17, it is not yet a very little while till Lebanon shall be turned into a fruitful field, the fruitful field be esteemed as a forest, and in that day the deaf shall hear, and then the eyes of the blind shall see further on, and the poor will have the gospel preached to them, is the paraphrase of it using the New Testament. But in Matthew chapter 11 and verse 2, we find that Jesus uses this as the explanation for who he is for John the Baptist. So in Matthew chapter 11, John the Baptist sends messengers to Jesus. They ask, are you the one we're waiting for? And Jesus essentially says, go tell John. The eyes of the blind are open, the deaf hear, the lame walk, the poor have the gospel preached to them. He lists those as the signs of the spiritual kingdom coming. And verse 7 is included in that. The second half of verse 6 and verse 7, the waters shall burst forth in the wilderness and streams in the desert. The parched ground shall become a pool, and the thirsty land springs of water. In the habitation of jackals where each lay, there shall be grass with reeds and rushes. So earlier on, pretty recently in the book, he's talked about how Judah is going to be laid waste. It's going to be desolate. It's going to be a dwelling place of jackals and animals. But this indicates that there's going to be springs of water. The habitation of jackals where each lay there shall be grass with reeds and rushes. So there's going to be a reblooming of God's place where he's set his name, where he's set his people. That judgment isn't going to last forever. There's going to be a reemergence of life there. Verse 8 is interesting. It says, a highway shall be there, and a road, and it shall be called the highway of holiness. The unclean shall not pass over it, but it shall be for others. Whoever walks the road, although a fool, shall not go astray. The highway is used by Isaiah throughout the book as sort of aspect of the holy of the spiritual kingdom, the holy kingdom of Jesus. Where he says in chapter 11, take me a second to flip there. In Isaiah chapter 11, verse 16, he says, there will be a highway for the remnant of his people who will be left from Assyria, as it was for Israel in the day he came up from the land of Egypt. So So there's a highway there for the remnant. Okay? And then in chapter 19, in verse 23, Isaiah says, "In that day there will be a highway from Egypt to Assyria, and the Assyrian will come into Egypt, and the Egyptian into Assyria, and the Egyptians will serve with the Assyrians." And notice verse 24 and 25. "In that day Israel will be one of three with Egypt and Assyria, a blessing in the midst of the land, whom the Lord of hosts shall bless, saying, Blessed is Egypt, my people, and Assyria, the work of my hands, and Israel, my inheritance." So they're a conglomeration of heathen nations and God's original selected people, and just talking about spiritual kingdom, the borders being opened there, that highway existing. Then he brings it back in chapter 35 with the verses we just read. "A highway shall be there, and road shall be called the highway of holiness. The unclean shall not pass over it." And it even says, "Whoever walks the road, although a fool, shall not go astray." Then he continues on in verse 9. "No lion shall be there, nor shall any ravenous beast go up on it. It shall not be found there, but the redeemed shall walk there. And the ransomed of the Lord shall return and come to Zion with singing, with everlasting joy on their heads. They shall obtain joy and gladness, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away." So there we see very obvious language talking about a spiritual kingdom. Everlasting joy, the redeemed, the ransomed of the Lord, and this perfect peace that Isaiah keeps bringing back. After all this stuff goes on, there's going to be perfect peace for my remnant, for my people. Talking about a spiritual kingdom there. Chapter 35 was short. The next few chapters are long. So we're probably not going to get all the way through the historical link tonight, but we'll see how far we get. So we get into chapter 36, and remember, keep that the admonishment from chapter 35 in your mind. Be strong, do not fear, behold, your God will come with vengeance. Keep that in your mind. That Isaiah's message for this situation is that. So he says in chapter 36 and verse 1, "It came to pass in the 14th year of King Hezekiah that Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up against all the fortified cities of Judah and took them." Remember from the beginning of the book, it said that Assyria would invade Judah and reach up to the neck. The floodwaters of Assyria would reach up to the neck. So Jerusalem being the head, he takes all the fortified cities of Judah, and now he's going to try to take Jerusalem. It's reaching up to the neck, just like Isaiah said it would. What's interesting about this is it sets out that it's the 14th year of Hezekiah's reign. And it's important for our understanding of the timeline here, because there's some date math that we're going to do eventually that puts chapter 36 and 37 simultaneous with chapter 38. So chapter 38 is another narrative from Isaiah, but it happens simultaneously, overlaid on top of the other two chapters, historically, chronologically. So keep that in mind, 14th year of Hezekiah's reign. Verse 2, "Then the king of Assyria, Sennacherib, sent the Rabshakeh with a great army from Lachish to King Hezekiah at Jerusalem. And he stood by the aqueduct from the upper pool on the highway to the fuller's field." In all the research that I did, I couldn't really find out an exact reason why it lists the exact place. Probably just that it was within earshot of people, because that was the Rabshakeh's point, was to be intimidating and to discourage all the soldiers with his speech. So there's not an exact, my understanding is there's not a real known reason why it says that place, but that's the place he chose. Rabshakeh, remember, is not a name, it is a title. It's a title for the spokesman of the king of Assyria. If you remember back in the beginning of the book, there's a title used for the general of the army of the king of Assyria, but it's not actually the name of the person, it's just his title. So Rabshakeh here is not the name of the person speaking, it's just his station. He is the Rabshakeh. In verse 3, "Then Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, who was over the household of Shebna the scribe, and Joah, the son of Asaph, the recorder, came out to him." So there's a couple people sent from Jerusalem to go meet with this person. "Then the Rabshakeh said to them," so he's going to start just right off the bat, he's going to start reproaching God and reproaching the king. Say now to Hezekiah, thus says the great king, the king of Assyria, what confidence is this in which you trust? I say you speak of having plans and power for war, but they are mere words. Now in whom do you trust that you rebel against me? Look, you are trusting in the staff of his broken reed, Egypt, on which if a man leans, it will go into his hand and pierce him. So is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to all who trust in him. Remember, Isaiah condemned the alliance with Egypt. He says, Hezekiah, that's not going to work. And here the Rabshakeh even explains, if you lean on Egypt, it's going to be like you're leaning on a reed or a walking stick and it breaks and it goes through your hand. It's gonna handicap you, no pun intended, but it's gonna cripple you when you were supposed to be leaning on it. He says that's how Egypt would be. Verse 7, Rabshakeh continues, but if you say to me, we trust in the Lord our God, is it not he whose high places and whose altars Hezekiah has taken away and said to Judah and Jerusalem, you shall worship before this altar? Now, Rabshakeh makes it a point to be very blasphemous throughout his entire speech to these people. Part of what he says in verse 7 is that Hezekiah took down the Lord, their God's altars. Hezekiah didn't take down the Lord's altar. Hezekiah took down the high places of pagan worship. And he said, you have to worship at Jerusalem like it was supposed to be. Worship at the temple. But the Rabshakeh is sort of sarcastically or inadvertently making God on par with the pagan idols that they had been worshiping that Hezekiah took out of the way. So that's blasphemous, verse 7 is. Verse 8, now therefore I urge you, he continues, give a pledge to my master, the king of Assyria, and I will give you 2,000 horses, if you are able on your part to put riders on them. How then will you repel one captain of the least of my master's servants and put your trust in Egypt for chariots and horsemen? Have I now come up without the Lord against this land to destroy it? The Lord said to me, go up against this land and destroy it. A couple interesting things here. Verse 8 is kind of a taunt. He says, even if my army gave you 2,000 horses and men to put on them, you still couldn't beat one of our captains. It's a taunt against Hezekiah, and Hezekiah probably didn't even have that kind of military, 2,000 horses. They were the oppressed kingdom in this situation, underdogs. And then verse 9, if you put your trust in Egypt and we give you 2,000 horses, you're still not going to beat one of our captains. Verse 10, he says, have I now come up without the Lord against this land to destroy it? The Lord said to me, go up against this land and destroy it. Haley puts this as a taunt against Hezekiah and Israel. A couple other commentators would say that the Lord, kind of like King Cyrus, where the Lord put it on his heart, the Bible says it put it on King Cyrus's heart to send Jews back to Jerusalem to rebuild it. A couple commentators put this situation on par with that. But the king of Assyria, we know from previous prophecies from Isaiah about this situation that's happening now, the king of Assyria grew very prideful about the fact that he had military might and didn't acknowledge that God had given him that power. And that was part of God's complaint against him. And it will be eventually more of God's complaint against him and the reason the king of Assyria is given so many judgments. That the king of Assyria did not know that God was the one who gave him that power. He thought, this is my power. So I don't think in this situation that it's God actually told Sennacherib to go and take Jerusalem, because Sennacherib didn't know that God had told him to go and take Jerusalem. In verse 11, here's that spot where the Rabshakeh intentionally tries to intimidate the people in the city. It says in verse 11, then Eliakim, Shebna, and Joah said to the Rabshakeh, please speak to your servants, referring to themselves as his servants, in Aramaic, for we understand it. Do not speak to us in Hebrew in the hearing of the people who are on the wall. So they say, talk to us in Aramaic so we can have a conversation without making our people panic behind us. Okay, Rabshakeh then stands up and calls out with a loud voice in Hebrew and said, "Hear the words of the great king, the king of Assyria. Thus says the king, do not let Hezekiah deceive you, for he will not be able to deliver you, nor let Hezekiah make you trust in the Lord, saying, the Lord will surely deliver us. This city will not be given into the hand of the king of Assyria. Do not listen to Hezekiah, for thus says the king of Assyria, make peace with me by a present and come out to me. For every one of you eat from his own vine, and every one from his own fig tree, and every one of you drink from the waters of his own cistern, until I come and take you away to a land like your own land, a land of grain and new wine, a land of bread and vineyards." So there, Rabshakeh kind of brings in this practice of conquering nations in the Middle East at the time, where they would take over a spot, and then they would like kind of switch the population out to control the culture. So they would, he's saying, they would take away the population of Jerusalem and replace it with Assyrians, sort of, and try to take over the culture of the land in that way. He says in verse 18, "Beware lest Hezekiah persuade you, saying, the Lord will deliver us. Has any one of the gods of the nations delivered its land from the hand of the king of Assyria? Where are the gods of Hamath and Arpad? Where are the gods of Sepharvaim? Indeed, have they delivered Samaria from my hand? Who among all the gods of these lands has delivered their countries from my hand, that the Lord should deliver Jerusalem from my hand?" It's interesting. Who is supposed to be the god of Samaria? Yahweh. But the king of Assyria lists Hamath, Arpad, Sepharvaim, not the Lord God of Israel. Just kind of shows that even the nations around them recognized that that wasn't their God anymore. It wasn't just between Samaria and Jerusalem and Judah. But then he even puts God, the Lord God, on the same level as all these idols. He says, well, okay, those guys didn't defend their land, so your guy's not going to defend your land from me either. And so it shows his pagan ideology that he acknowledged Yahweh's existence, but thought, yeah, there's lots of gods. That's just the God of Israel. And so it shows Sennacherib's personal paganism, but then it's also just very blasphemous toward the God of Israel, who's the one true God. In verse 21, Hezekiah's servants show a lot of restraint as far as this situation goes. It says in verse 21, "But they held their peace and answered him not a word, for the king's commandment was, do not answer him." So, you know, it would be really hard to stand there and as a loyal servant to King Hezekiah and to the Lord, just stand there and let this person shout at the top of their lungs blasphemy against God and also reproach against the king, his anointed. And it would be really hard to just stand there and take it and hold your peace. But they did. They didn't answer him. In verse 22, "Then Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, who was over the household, Shebna the scribe, and Joah, the son of Asaph, the recorder, came to Hezekiah with their clothes torn and told him the words of the Rabshakeh." If you remember back in chapter 33, when Isaiah is prophesying about this situation, he says in verse 7 of chapter 33, "Surely their valiant ones shall cry outside." So that would be the Rabshakeh. "And then the ambassadors of peace shall weep bitterly." That would be lining up with the servants of Hezekiah, the Eliakim, Shebna, and Joah. So they are the servants who are coming back in and weeping and crying. Do you have any comments up to this point? I know I've been kind of moving pretty quick.
Well, he's talking about vengeance, God's vengeance. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have that in Hebrews. Mm-hmm. Chapter 10, verse 30 and 31. "For we know him that hath said, vengeance belongeth unto me. I will recompense, saith the Lord. And again, the Lord shall judge his people. It is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God."
Indeed.
So we see the vengeance there today.
Yeah. And we even see sort of now that vengeance is mine, that's a quotation from an Old Testament passage. But we even see the servants of Hezekiah here in this account practicing that. If they had tried to take vengeance on the Rabshakeh, it wouldn't have gone so well. There was a great army behind them. They didn't have the power to take vengeance, to bring in, use their wrath to bring in justice there. It wasn't available. That wasn't a possibility. But what they did was they restrained themselves and said, Lord, you heard this, right? And that's sort of what Hezekiah does too. As we go through the next couple chapters, we'll see. They basically just say, you reproached God, and God heard it. So your judgment's coming. Sometimes that's kind of hard for us to do. So I think that's neat. I would encourage you, as we we'll go through maybe like a few verses of chapter 37. I don't want to get super all the way into it because we're starting to run out of time. But I would encourage you, as you go through the next week, read through chapter 36, 37, 38. And kind of in your brain, line chapter 38 up with chapter 36 and 37. Because it's important to remember. So in chapter 38, a brief summary is Hezekiah gets sick with some terminal illness. And Isaiah comes to him and says, you're going to die. God says to put your house in order because you're not going to recover from this. And Hezekiah just simply prays, Lord, remember the good that I've done for you in your name. And then God extends his life 15 years. Okay? There's our date math. He extends Hezekiah's life 15 years. Hezekiah's total reign was 29 years. Remember, in the 14th year of Hezekiah's reign, Sennacherib came against Jerusalem. So during the year 701 BC, if you want to get exact, during that same year where Hezekiah was deathly ill is when Assyria was mounting their army, setting up to go against Jerusalem. And that's when the Rabshakeh was coming and saying, we're going to destroy you. Your king is ill. Your king is sickly. He's not going to save you. Your God's not going to save you. And that's why Isaiah's admonishment in chapter 35 is so important, because he says, behold, your God will come with vengeance. He's preparing them for getting through this situation. He's preparing Hezekiah for getting through this situation. Hezekiah recovers. And then at the end of chapter 38, it says, Hezekiah had said, what is the sign that I shall go up to the house of the Lord? Go back to chapter 37. After Sennacherib sends him a threatening letter, Hezekiah goes up to the house of the Lord and spreads that message out before God. He says, look, this is what the reproach is against you and against us. Please take care of it. And in chapter 36, I would say chapter 36 is during his illness. Chapter 37 is immediately after his recovery, is how I would line those things up. So read through that, kind of put those things together in your mind over the next week, because it's important to recognize what's happening when, as we go through this little historical brief link of his historical narrative in the prophecy. You got any questions or anything before we get into chapter 37 just a minute? Chapter 37, the first couple verses. It says, and so it was when King Hezekiah heard it, that he tore his clothes, covered himself with sackcloth, and went into the house of the Lord. Notice that is a stark contrast to the reaction that Ahaz had when an army was coming against him. When Ahaz saw, oh, there's a big army, let's go make an alliance with Assyria because they're stronger than we are and they can take care of us. Hezekiah's reaction was, here's a big army, tears his clothes, goes into the house of the Lord to inquire of the Lord. That's an important reaction. Verse 2, then he sent Eliakim, who was over the household, Shebna the scribe, and the elders of the priests, covered with sackcloth, to Isaiah the prophet, the son of Amos. So instead of God having to send Isaiah to intercept the king on his way somewhere and pronounce a judgment because he didn't inquire of the Lord, this time the king sends people to the prophet and says, go ask him what we need to do. It's a much better way of handling the situation than Ahaz ever did. In verse 3, and they said to him, thus says Hezekiah, so this is Hezekiah's message to Isaiah, this day is a day of trouble and rebuke and blasphemy, for the children have come to birth, but there is no strength to bring them forth. That's just a metaphor. I don't know if it's actually a metaphor or what kind of figure of speech it is, but it's a figure for a time of extreme difficulty. So if a woman is ready for childbirth, but she has no strength, that's going to be rough. That's going to be hard. So Hezekiah is saying to Isaiah, this is what this time is like for us. Verse 4, it may be that the Lord your God will hear the words of the Rabshakeh, whom his master the king of Assyria has sent to reproach the living God, and will rebuke the words which the Lord your God has heard. Therefore lift up your prayer for the remnant that is left. Notice, Hezekiah doesn't try to take matters into his own hands and say, you reproached me, you reproached God, I'm going to go fight you. He says, Lord, you heard what this person said. This is your territory, you take care of it. That's a good way to handle the situation. Verse 5, the servants of King Hezekiah go to Isaiah, they say those things to him. And in verse 6, there's Isaiah's response. Isaiah said to them, thus you shall say to your master, thus says the Lord, do not be afraid of the words which you have heard, with which the servants of the king of Assyria have blasphemed me. Surely I will send a spirit upon him, and he shall hear a rumor and return to his own land, and I will cause him to fall by the sword in his own land. If you want the spoiler, go read chapter 37, verse 36 to 38. It happens exactly as God said it would. He hears a rumor, returns to his own land, falls by the sword in his own land, doesn't even bother Jerusalem. And God also fulfills the prophecies that where Isaiah said, you can't trust in Egypt. God's going to be the one to defend Jerusalem. It's not going to be the sword of man that takes care of this. It's going to be the sword of God. And all of these things that Isaiah has been talking about to this point are coming true. And the signs that he uses even come true. I'll give you a sneak peek at the next few verses. That's where we're going to stop for the evening. But from the next few verses, we learn that this is really important to God, because I think that there were two times, if my memory serves me correctly, where God actually set time back a little bit or held it still, where he literally where he manipulated time. When Joshua says, sun stand still, and then over, can't remember the places, but Joshua asks for the sun to stand still, God commands the sun to stand still, and the Lord fights for Israel. And they win that battle because the sun stayed in the sky. And this time, the sign given to Hezekiah is the shadow of the sundial goes back 5 marks. So this situation is really important to God, because he doesn't make that kind of a sign very often. So it's an interesting thing to look at. So I'd encourage you to read through this a little bit and line some of these things up chronologically in your mind, because it's important to think about that stuff. That's where we'll stop for the evening. If there's anybody who is subject to the invitation, who needs prayers, needs help with anything, needs to talk about something or study about something, or if you feel the need to obey the gospel tonight and you know what to do, then this invitation is for you. So if you have a need, please come forward while we stand and sing.